ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
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 युद्धि
Turaga,
Rajo, Vidhumra, Vishwak, Kacha, Tulita, Shramavarya, Lankritasye, Mama, Nishita, Sharer, Vidhidyamana, Vachi, Vilasat, Kavache, Stu, Krishna, Atma, Yudhi Turaga, Rajo Vidhumra Vishvak, Kacha Lita Shramavarya Alankritasye Mama Nishita Sharer Vibhiyamana Tvachi Vilasat Kavachestu Krishna Atma Yudhi Turaga Rajo Vidhumra Vishvak Kacha Lulita Shramavarya Alankritasye Mama Nishita Sharer Vidhidyamana Vashivilasat Kavache Stu Krishna Atma Yudhi Turaga Rajo Vidhumra Vishvak Kachalulita Shramavarya Alankritasye Mama Nishita Sharer Vidhidyamana Kachi Vilasat Kavache Stu Krishna Atma Yudhi,
on the battlefield.
Turaga.
Turaga.
Horses.
Horses.
Raja.
Raja.
Dust.
Dust.
Vidhumbra.
Vidhumbra.
Turned an ashen color.
Turned an ashen color.
Vishva.
Vishva.
Waving.
Waving.
Kacha.
Kacha.
Hair.
Hair.
Lulita.
Lulita.
Scattered.
Scattered.
Shramavari.
Shramavari.
Perspiration.
Perspiration.
Alankrita.
Alankrita.
Decorated with.
Decorated with.
Asye.
Asye.
Unto the face.
Unto the face.
Mama.
Mama.
My.
My.
Nishita.
Nishita.
Sharp.
Sharp.
Sharai.
Sharai.
By the arrows.
By the arrows.
Vidya. Vidyamana.
Vidyamana.
Pierced by.
Pierced by.
Vachi.
Vachi.
In the skin.
In the skin.
Vilasat.
Vilasat.
Enjoying pleasure.
Enjoying pleasure.
Kavache.
Kavache.
Protecting armor.
Protecting armor.
Astu.
Astu.
Let there be.
Let there be.
Krishne.
Krishne.
Unto Sri Krishna.
Unto Sri Krishna.
Atma.
Atma.
Mind.
Mind.
Translation. On the battlefield where Sri Krishna attended Arjuna out of friendship, the flowing hair of Lord Krishna turned ashen due to the dust raised by the hooves of the horses. And because of his labor, beads of sweat wetted his face. All these decorations, intensified by the wounds dealt by my sharp arrows, were enjoyed by him. Let my mind thus go unto Sri Krishna. Purport. The Lord is the absolute form of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. As such, transcendental loving service to the Lord in one of the five principal relationships, namely Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya, etc. Also neutrality, also known as neutrality, servitorship, fraternity, filial affection, and conjugal love, is graciously accepted by the Lord when offered to the Lord in genuine love and affection. Sri Bhishmadev is a great devotee of the Lord in the relation of servitorship. Thus his throwing of sharp arrows at the transcendental body of the Lord is as good as the worship of another devotee who throws soft roses upon him. It appears that Bhishmadev is repenting the actions he committed against the person of the Lord. If actually the Lord's body was not at all pain due to his transcendental existence. His body is not matter. Both he himself and his body are complete spiritual identity. Spirit is never pierced, burnt, dried, moistened, etc. This is vividly explained in the Bhagavad Gita. So also it is stated in the Skanda Purana. It is said that spirit is always uncontaminated and indestructible. It cannot be distressed, nor can it be dried up. When Lord Vishnu in his incarnation appears before us, he seems to be like one of the conditioned souls, materially encaged, just to bewilder the asuras or the non-believers, who are always alert to kill the Lord, even from the very beginning of his appearance. Kamsa wanted to kill Krishna, and Ravana wanted to kill Ram, because foolishly they were unaware of the fact that the Lord is never killed, for the spirit is never annihilated. Therefore, Bhishmadeva's piercing of the body of Lord Krishna is a sort of bewildering problem for the non-devotee atheist. But those who are devotees or liberated souls are not bewildered. Bhishmadeva predicted the all-merciful attitude of the Lord, appreciated. Bhishmadeva appreciated the all-merciful attitude of the Lord because he did not leave Arjuna alone, although he was disturbed by the sharpened arrows of Bhishmadeva. Nor was he reluctant to come before Bhishma's deathbed, even though he was ill-treated by him on the battlefield. Bhishma's repentance and the Lord's merciful attitude are both unique in this picture. Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, a great acharya and devotee in the humor of conjugal love with the Lord, remarks very saliently in this regard. He says that the wounds created on the body of the Lord by the sharpened arrows of Bhishmadeva were as pleasing to the Lord as the biting of a fiancé who bites the Lord's body directed by a strong sense of sex desire. Such biting by the opposite sex is never taken as a sign of enmity, even if there is a wound on the body, Therefore, the fighting as an exchange of transcendental pleasure between the Lord and his pure devotee, Sri Bhishmadev, was not at all mundane. Besides that, since the Lord's body and the Lord are identical, there was no possibility of wounds in the absolute body. The apparent wounds caused by the sharpened arrows are misleading to the common man, but one who has a little absolute knowledge can understand the transcendental exchange in the chivalrous relationship. The Lord was perfectly happy with the wounds caused by the sharpened arrows of Bhishmadev. The word vibhidyamana is significant because the Lord's skin is not different from the Lord. Because our skin is different from our soul, in our case, the word vidyamana, or being bruised or cut, would have been quite suitable. Transcendental bliss is of different varieties, and the varieties of activities in the mundane world is but a perverted reflection of transcendental bliss. Because everything in the mundane world is qualitatively mundane, it is full of inebrieties. Whereas in the absolute realm, because everything is of the same absolute nature, there are varieties of enjoyment without inebriety. The Lord enjoyed the wounds created by his great devotee Bhishmadev, and because Bhishmadev is a devotee in the chivalrous relationship, he fixes up his mind on Krishna in that wounded condition. So here we see that Bhishmadev has changed now his mood, or at least let's say he's manifesting his internal mood. That up to this point, then he's been describing the whole Varnashram system, because he's been asked by Yudhishthira Maharaj to do so. And in that system, he's explaining how to connect ourselves with the Supreme Lord through the performance of our occupational duties. So this has been very elaborately described by him. And so now that that's been described and the sun has moved to the north, so now he is switching his mood to just meditating upon the Supreme Lord and not being absorbed in these performance of occupational duties. So one may feel that, well, there's a great change in the mood, or it's inconsistent, or one may think, well, what does all this Varnashram have to do with the devotional activities, or now what does all this sentiment have to do with the devotional activities? So this is an important aspect, it's an important question. Because the rasa, that is what's important. Everything else doesn't actually matter. You know, it's not important. Because whatever is done is actually only for the purpose of rasa. Unfortunately, many times we will mistake what rasa we're looking for and throw it onto something else. So we don't actually understand what is the rasa we're getting. Like we'll have the feeling that, yes, I want to be wealthy. So having the money, then we'll feel that makes us happy. But it's actually not. It's what we can do with the money in relationship with others, you know, that have some meaning to us. Then that interaction or that rasa that is gained from that, that's actually what's important. But to do it, you have to have the money. Does that make sense? Because the rasa is not inherent. Because we're dealing with dead matter in the material world. So rasa is not the common principle. It's not the common given. But in the spiritual world, because rasa is the common principle, because everything's functioning in rasa, the form of the devotee is manifest by rasa, Krishna is rasa, everything, all exchanges, every activity is rasa. So there's no need to establish this kind of importance to gain opulence, right? Because rasa is tasted through opulence, right? Krishna tastes rasa through interacting with his opulence, right? With his potencies. His potencies are his opulence. So there's no need to gain it to enjoy it because it's already there. It's inherent. Krishna's rasa. His devotees are manifesting through rasa. Their exchanges are rasa. Everything's rasa. So then there's no need to gain something to taste. You just simply taste. Right? Like in the material world, you have to take the mango, you have to peel it, you have to take out the seed, then you can eat it.
spiritual world, that's not the problem. Right? Does that make some sense? Not that their mangoes don't have skins or seeds, they may or may not, but my point is it's material world, first you have to get through something undesirable to get at what's desirable. Right? Opulence is gained through austerity. So without austerity, there is no opulence. And without opulence, then there's no happiness. Does that make sense? It says opulence can be whatever. Renunciation is also an opulence. Or knowledge is an opulence. Just means any of the Lord's qualities, those are opulence. So then, without austerity, you don't get them. So you always have to get through that mundane matter before you can get at the taste of interaction. Does that make sense? It's always. The austerity creates opulence. Opulence then is the facility for exchange or rasa. So, since Bhishma is on the transcendental platform, then therefore for him, moving through these different rasas is not a problem. So he's describing Varnashram, but for him, that's rasa. Because you're going to be engaged in the occupational duties to please the Lord. But basically you're engaging the mundane mind and mundane senses and mundane facilities. But it's being engaged in the Lord's service. So rasa is there. For those who know, they can taste through here. But at some point, then we see here, then the devotees want to function on the unimpeded platform. So that's dropped. These occupational duties, all that's dropped, and he simply absorbs himself in remembering the Lord. Because otherwise before, it would be, he'd be looking here, he would be noticing that Krishna's there in the chariot, and that he's covered with dust. So then that means he's, you know, he's a sweater there, he's fatigued. That means now he can attack, he can be successful. Right? That's in the platform of occupational duties. But now he's dropping all that, and so now he's just appreciating how the interaction of the Lord with his devotees. It means Krishna's out there simply because of his affection for Arjuna. He's not out there for any other reason. He wants to kill everybody, he doesn't need to be on the battlefield. Right? He can do that in other ways. There's not a need for this. Whatever Krishna's desire happens. But because of the desire to interact with the devotees, that's the real reason he comes. He comes to interact with the devotees. Then, to make it favorable that others may also take up the position of acting as devotees, therefore you have to establish religion. Does that make sense? Because you're trying to go from the non-devotional attitude to the devotional. That bridges occupational duties engaged in the Lord's service. Does that make sense? Because otherwise, you don't know what is rasa. Right? That's not the thing. Because we'll always say, you know, what's rasa? What's good? You know, what makes you happy? And then we'll have a long list of things, you know, position, fame, wealth, women, sense, all these things will become up. But those aren't where taste is. You have money, it's sitting there. Where's the taste? You can be happy that you have it, but that's what do you call it? That's intransitive. It's not doing anything. It exists. Does that make some sense? There's no action happening. I am happy. Okay, so why? What's going on? Nothing. It's just a state of existence. But there's no interaction. So by interaction, it's increased. That's where it actually starts to happen. So therefore, it's not. So we always will mistake the thing for what is the happiness. The happiness is something else. The happiness is interaction. Does this make sense? So that's the point. And the interaction is not dependent upon the externals, the gross material energy. It's not dependent upon that. Right? We may prefer this or that. You know, somebody goes into their house, you know, they close the door, the curtains are closed. It doesn't matter whether they're on the ground floor, they're in the basement, they're in the attic, or they're on the 87th floor. It doesn't matter. But there's the sense that I will be more happy if my apartment is, you know, on the 87th floor. Right? Then it gives something. But once you go inside the house, it doesn't matter. You know, you can't be in your house and appreciate. You can feel below your feet 86 other floors, right? You know, you can feel them all. Yes, all those people underneath. Yeah, you know. No, that doesn't happen. Like once one devotee was asking on this, you know, that the about dogs, right? You have this dog sitting there in the 87th floor in the apartment on the, you know, upper west side, you know, and he's eating at the table, you know, the most choicest food, wearing some nice little knitted sweater. It is on his own plates and everything like that, off the table with the other members of the family. Or you have the dog at the Ganga, you know, just wandering around, no place, no master, and just eating whatever dead comes by, you know, floating in the river. And so the question was, how is it that one dog is enjoying so much, you know, in the one situation, the other one is suffering so much in the other? And Prabhupada said to the dog, it doesn't matter. Dog couldn't care less, right? You know, dog is not appreciating the threads, you know, he's not sitting there laughing. Meat threads. Right? He couldn't care less. Doesn't mean anything to him. Like, wow, hey, check out this china. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't. You know, it really doesn't matter. So that's the thing, is that it doesn't matter. So the living entity is only idea that matters, but it doesn't. So therefore, for us, there is a difference because we're not seeing rasa. We're trying to taste rasa, but we don't actually know what rasa is. Otherwise, we wouldn't use the methods that we use to taste it. Right? So that's, you know, like the kids. You know, you take the food, you put it on the spoon, right? And then you turn it this way and put it in the mouth, right? So the food drops off onto the lap. But there's some taste on the spoon. So when you put it in the mouth, then you get a taste, right? Because, you know, food's not for, it's just for tasting. It's not for anything else, right? You know, and laps are meant for food, right? You know, laps, stomachs, heads, you know, it's all meant for food. It absorbs through the pores, right? That's the science. If you ever wondered why babies stay alive, because they absorb through the skin, right? Because what goes in the mouth is never enough, right? Like that. So that's the method. So if one doesn't know, one doesn't get fully out of it. It doesn't matter. Just there's some sensation, that's all. So Bhishma Devas, because he is Rasik, therefore he can move through this. And here is someone in his chivalrous rasa in servitorship. Right? Within servitorship, then the chivalry is the prominent element. So then that means chivalry means they're fighting as equals, or they're dealing as equals. And but he's appreciating the Lord, the beads of sweat, his hair flowing, the ashen color from the dust raised by the hooves, you know, on the battlefield. So he's appreciating all these fine elements of rasa, that interaction, that he's there because of the affection for Arjuna. Right? That's the real thing. He's affectionate to Arjuna, therefore he's there. Otherwise, they could have not fought, or he could have just come out there and then one day wiped everyone out with his Sudarshan. It doesn't take much to do that. But Krishna wanted to taste the rasa, so therefore the mystic potencies don't give the greatest taste, because it's just you and that potency, but the interaction with others isn't so great. That's why the devotees don't get so much into using their mystic powers, because the dependency on the Lord, the interaction with the Lord, it's not very important. So unless it brings that out, then it's not used. Does that make sense? Someone on the liberated platform has all the eight mystic cities, but they don't use them because they want to see how the Lord interacts. So we see that that's what's important for Bhishma Dev here. Does this make any sense? Are we getting anywhere? Or somehow or another? Yeah. So the whole point is rasa, but it's a matter of what rasa is being tasted. That's why Bhagavatam is for the Paramahamsas. Paramahamsana. In the third verse, then it mentions, and we see from there it mentions it's for the thoughtful persons, and those persons are able to taste nectar. That's what they're able to do. That is their position. So that means then the whole Bhagavatam will be based on this. O expert and thoughtful men, relish Srimad Bhagavatam, the mature fruit of the desire tree of Vedic literatures. It emanated from the lips of Sri Sukadev Goswami. Therefore this fruit has become even more tasteful, although its nectarian juice was already relishable for all, including liberated souls. So this is who it's for. Right? The invocation should explain what is the topic, should respect the deity, say the topic, say what will be gained by it, and say who it's for. So here it is for those expert men who can relish, and it's for relishing. So then we can understand that the Bhagavatam is meant for that, though we may see it on so many levels. As it said that Bhishma Dev, in his explaining Yudhishthira's questions, there are thousands of meanings. There's no one meaning. Thousands of meanings can be gained from it. This is his expertise. So then, in this, then, you know, some are brought out, you know, but main is the relishing. So this is the point, is that we have to be able to appreciate this. So we see that sometimes there's a problem. Varnashram is not appreciated. Rasa is not appreciated. Right? I mean, many times I've heard in the circles of devotees, if you bring up anything about rasa, oh, you don't talk about that. And varnashram, you don't talk about that. So then, what do you talk about? You know what I'm saying? Where are you going to get your taste? Right? So therefore, since it's not coming from engaging your occupational duties in the Lord, and it's not coming from tasting the Lord, then to some degree it comes from the sadhana, like that. But the problem is, unless you take the sadhana deeper by relishing, or by appreciating the connection to Krishna, then where's the taste going to come from? Therefore, you find many times devotees after some years look for the taste elsewhere. Right? It means their chanting goes on, these things go on. But those go into the background. In the foreground comes something else. Right? Does this make sense? And because it has to give some taste, like it says here, all these decorations intensified by the wounds dealt by my sharp arrows. Right? So, means you have to have something and then you have to intensify it. Right? This is how the rasa will work. Does that make sense? Something is going on. There's an interaction going on. But then there's something to intensify it. Right? If there's some closeness, then you have to intensify. So here, the sharp arrows, or something seems contradictory. Right? But something has to be there to intensify. You're sitting, eating a meal, some nice music is there, or some other scenery, or something is there to add, to intensify. Does that make sense? This is how the rasa will function. So here it's intensified by the sharp arrows. So therefore, since the taste is not coming from, actually directly from the devotional activities, and it's not coming from the activities being technically engaged in the Lord's service through occupational duty, right? Or the appreciation of the elements of rasa that are there in the Lord's pastimes, then it must come out of something that has to intensify. So generally speaking, it will be issues, right? Because issues then resonate in the mind. Issues then are connected to our value system. Right? They're generally lower value system, because any ism means pranamoya. Right? That's the how you say it? Given. As soon as you put an ism on the end of anything, it becomes pranamoya. So that means sub-religious. It's not actually occupational duty. And it has a touch of emotion to it. So then it gives us some taste. But it doesn't give a very deep taste. It can't, because of the nature of it. Because it's just extended sense gratification. Because sense gratification is temporary, therefore we see issues are temporary. Occupational duties last a lifetime. right? But issues don't last a lifetime. Issues come and go with the wind, right? You can come out in the morning, you know, wet your finger, put it out, and then see which way the wind's blowing. And then you can, you know, figure, you know, what's going to happen today. You know, oh, this issue's up. Oh, no, that issue's up. So these intensify. So then we see here is that one has to be able to move in these fields. Otherwise, where are you going to move? Where are you going to get your taste in Krishna consciousness? Right? This is a real question. And you have to be able to give an answer. Right? Otherwise, where are you going to get the taste? Right? Because the alternative, if you're not situated in prema, or at least in bhava, is material life. Right? That's what you got. Right? Eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Right? Very popular. Right? You know? Then, you know, wealth, position, knowledge, renunciation, beauty, and what's the last one? Fame. These are the options, right? Is there another option? So if we're not getting it in Krishna consciousness, which means rasa is being tasted through. We have three fields you can taste rasa within, right? You don't have a fourth. The senses, the mind, you know, means the emotions, or transcendence. So if the transcendence isn't tasted, that leaves you with emotions and the senses. And if the emotions and the senses aren't engaged in the Lord's service through the directions of the scriptures, then what you have is mundane taste. And now and again you relieve yourself by, you know, some devotional activity. Right? Does this make sense? So this is the reality of what we're dealing with. So then the idea is how to go beyond, how to go farther, how to go deeper into the devotional process. Why just leave it with a sprinkling or a smattering of devotional activities here and there in the day? I mean, how long is Mangalarti? Right? How long does it take to chant our rounds? Right? Okay, we take prasad. Okay, that one we do pretty good. Okay. Then that's a couple hours. Okay, 2, 3, 4 hours. What about the other 20 hours in the day? How is that connected to Krishna? Okay, we're doing our service, so that does. We're in the Dham, so you know every step is parikram and this and that. But that's unconscious. What we see here, Bhishma Dev specifically fixes his consciousness on Krishna. That's right, Krishna consciousness. Right, we're becoming purified, just like the, you know, the dog is becoming purified when you give him a bath. He doesn't understand why or how, right? You know, like that. You know, the cat understands even less. Right? At least the dog's submissive. Right? You know, so like that. So then, how do you say? So then. How will we progress? So these are questions. This is the meaning of Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Now it's time to inquire into the Supreme. How does the Supreme come into my life at all aspects? How are my senses, my emotions, my transcendental needs engaged in the Lord's service? Otherwise, then you're always going to be living a dual life, and it's painful. But unless you know the science, then we just, like a pendulum, swing back and forth, right? Fired up in the temple. I mean, here's a scenario, right? A real life scenario. In the temple, fired up, going for it, this and that. After a while, you know, interaction, politics, this, that, no taste. Been here a long time, no recognition. You know, we're not getting, you know, so now it's like that initial missionary spirit is kind of waning, then it's kind of like, what did I get for 20 years? You know, giving everything. So then, where's my position? Where's my facility? Where's this? Where's that? Right? Back to opulences. What do I have for me? Then, point out the door, you know, go out there, start our computer business, you know, get it up, go for it for 10 years, this and that. No taste here. Well, maybe back with the devotees. then sell everything, write that, move back into, you know, temple, go to the dham, buy yourself a flat, move in, you know, here we are, yeah, like this. Then after, you know, a few years, then what? Right? Especially if, you know, the family wasn't so Krishna conscious or whatever it was, gave them up, you know, moved in like this, fired up, doing full-time service, and then after a few years, then, you know, wow, hey, check out that girl. And then, you know, then you come back the next year and you see the guy and the girl riding the same rickshaw down the road. Right? And I'm not making these ones up. These ones are real. Like that. And so then, you know, it's just back and forth, back and forth. Fully in, then out, then in, then out. Right? So the middle is where we have to be. That's the razor's edge. So that means Krishna has to be connected. So this taste has to be, we have to be able to understand and function within our prescribed duties and appreciate it. If we're not the body, what's the problem? We're not the mind, the intelligence, the ego. What's the problem? What it is? Then we can function. At the same time, is where are we trying to get? The perfection of our occupational duties is not the top. Right? It'll be pretty close to the top if you're, you know, planning to go to Vaikuntha. But if you're planning to go to Vrindavan, then that's where you start. Right? Ramananda Roy started his conversation there. Lord Chaitanya said, what's the ultimate goal of life? He says, proper performance of one's occupational duties. You know, to please the Lord. And he said, okay, that's a start, but that's the external reason. That's what you're going to engage. What's external means external to the soul, means your body, your mind, your intelligence. That doesn't mean external means the body and the mind is internal. No, it means the soul is internal, everything else is external. Because Varnashram engages your mind, your intelligence, your false ego. So that's, and he started there, and then it took so many more levels till he finally got to what Lord Chaitanya was looking for. But if you say that to the Shris or Madhvas, they'll say, bingo. That's what we're trying to do. And the ultimate is then to develop that pure love. But the method we're going to use is the proper forms of occupational duties, because that's what they're going to do in Vaikuntha. That's the taste, proper performance of occupational duties. But in Vrindavan, they perfectly perform their occupational duties, but that's not the taste. The taste is simply just interacting with Krishna. So that's left behind. And we see even for those who are planning to go to Vaikuntha, the taste of Varnashram on this platform is also given up. And it's just absorption of the Lord. So you see, very sweet prayers. One wouldn't expect this from a warrior, right? He's talking on the battlefield where Sri Krishna attended Arjuna out of friendship. The flowing hair of Lord Krishna turned ashen due to the dust raised by the hooves of the horses. And because of his labor, beads of sweat wetted his face. All these decorations, intensified by the wounds dealt by my sharp arrows, were enjoyed by him. Let my mind thus go unto Sri Krishna. Right? Very poetic. Right? One doesn't expect that from a warrior. You know? But that's the platform. It's very nice. It's very sweet. But Vrindavan's more sweet. That's the thing. Everything is nice. We have a tendency, everything is, you know, put into nice little boxes. And very extreme. You know, there's the sweetness of Vrindavan and then the dryness of Vaikuntha. And the, you know, wonderfulness of Krishna and the not-so-wonderfulness of Vishnu and, you know, it's all like this, very extreme. The Prabhupada said we shouldn't make such, the distinction shouldn't be so great. We understand there's a difference in flavor, right? Because it goes deeper, it goes farther. So the sweetness is tasted by these devotees. But if the taste of the other, the rules and regulations, is also part of that flavor, while in Vrindavan, you clear out everything but the sweetness. And that's all that's left. Does that make some sense? It's not that the others aren't sweet. It's just that Vrindavan is exclusively sweet. The others are sweet plus something else. So that's why, because Vrindavan is pure, unalloyed sweetness, therefore you have to have pure unalloyed devotion to get there. While the others are variety of mixed devotional sentiments, therefore pure devotion is enough. You don't have to have pure unalloyed. Right? Does that make some sense? So then, yeah. So then, Bhishma is then appreciating all these rasas. The Lord is coming before. They're fighting on the battlefield, and because he's being hit by all these arrows, he's not leaving Arjuna. He's staying with them because of his relationship. At the same time, because of this, the fighting attitude, he's not coming before Bhishma on his deathbed that, no, you shot me with so many sharpened arrows. No. So he's appreciating that the Lord, for him, is just the rasa. That's what's important. That's ultimately what is important. But until we have rasa, the rules keep everything on the straight and narrow. Does that make sense? Because as soon as this is the problem, these are the two sides of the path. The sahajya is, it's the rasa that's important, therefore rules don't matter. And as long as I have some sentiment, then, you know, that's how we deal, right? I mean, we come across this all over the place. Here we have sahajyas, in the West we have born again. It's, you know, it's the same kind of sentiment. Then the other one is that the rule itself is what's actually important. By doing the rule, then it's there, but that's karma kandis. I perform the activity, I get the result, because I am the controller and the result is for me, so I enjoy it. The other one is I enjoy just the rasa, however I want to taste it. My mind goes this way, that way, whatever I want to do at the spur of the moment. Like that. You know, it's like the taste of sporadic devotion. So it's not real spontaneity. It's just whatever the mind brings up. So these two are the danger. And these two are the fields that we go through. Very strict in the temple and all that. Do we all follow all the rules and this and that? Anyone doesn't follow the rules, they're nonsense. Like that. And then, oh, we're just being practical. Why are you so fanatic? Why... Sound familiar? So these are the two sides, and neither of them have really anything to do with serious devotional service. Of the two, though, following the rules to please Krishna is better situated, because one will be purified by it, and hopefully by good association, one will take up the proper attitude. Well, if one doesn't follow anything, and one simply speculates on what will please the Lord, then you have no foundation. What do you have to deal with? At least the other, you know, God wrote the scriptures. So if you follow them, at least there's some connection. But, you know, our sentiment may not be enough unless it's based on the scriptures. So therefore, those who follow are better than those who don't. Right? That's the list. Of all living entities, then the movable are considered better than the immovable creatures. Of the movable, then the human is the best. Of human, then the Brahman. A Brahman, then one who has studied the scriptures. Of one who has studied, one who actually follows it. The one who follows it, one who understands it. One who understands it, one who's realized. Right? This is the delineation of the superiority of living entities. So, that's the point. But so at least one who follows is better than one who doesn't follow. Like that. So we have to see is that what we're being given is something very special. And so it has the combination of both. There is the taste and there is the following. Right? So we practice here following the rules and regulations that we're given, because in the spiritual world we're going to practice and follow in the footsteps of who's there. Right? So it's not imitating. Smart is imitate. But those who follow in the footsteps, then it's balanced, because it has both the elements of the rules and regulations and the taste or understanding of the of relationships. Any questions on this? Comments?
How much is
how much is rasa dependent on sadhana? How much is rules and regulations important in the balance of rasa, tasting of rasa? Means it's if one knows how to, it's just like this. Someone who is expert in a particular field, do they have to read the manual on how it functions? Yes or no? No, because they already know how it works and they're already getting that taste. But someone who doesn't know the field and doesn't know the taste has to read it, has to follow it. So that's the principle here. We always have, there's this point, actually it becomes bewildering how you say? It's not so bewildering for other sampradayas, because what you do here and what you do there basically looks the same. What's changed is that the purpose, the affections have changed. The affection for the Lord as opposed to affection for ourselves and what's important for us here. But the activities are the same. You know, the basic varnashram activities and all that are the same. So therefore it's very easy to deal with that. But for our mind, then there's a difficulty in which there is a direct, means you reflect it so it functions the same, but at the same time there's a complete change. Something is dropped. Does that make sense? In other words, when we say the rules and regulations are dropped, that means the rules and regulations as rules and regulations are dropped. It means that we're following it because it's the rule that's dropped. In the spiritual world, that's what they like to do. That's why it's made a rule here. Mother Yashoda likes to feed Krishna. Therefore, it's made a rule here that mothers should feed their kids. Right? A mother feeds her child, she'll be considered a good mother. Mother doesn't feed her child, neglects them, she'll be considered a bad mother. So in the rasa between mother and child, then feeding is one of the aspects. So therefore, it's made as a rule. Does that make sense? Because we don't actually know what is the rasa. That makes sense. We just go through it. This lifetime we're this, the next lifetime we're that. You know, so we're constantly changing species and situations. So every time it's new. So and without the rules and regulations, we won't know how to deal. Right? The animals, then the super soul guides them. So he tells them what to do. Okay, bark at this, sniff that, bite this, growl at that. You know, sleep here. You know, all these different things. So then they get the taste of being that living entity. But as a human, because it involves 8,400,000 tastes, you could choose any one of them. Therefore, without the rules, then you're not actually going to get human. Right? It means because one is embodied in a human form doesn't mean one's human. One's values, one's tastes, one's endeavors doesn't make it human. Right? Just like human life begins when we inquire. So if we're not inquiring, it's not human. You know, I mean, if they're inquiring about eating, sleeping, mating, defending, still it's animal, because animals inquire also. Like Prabhupada is saying that all these birds are chirping in the morning and evening, they're asking, where's sense gratification? Where's eating, sleeping, mating, defending? You know, we're saying, oh, so sweet, you know, that's what they're talking about. You know. If you have the transcendental ears, then here in the Dham, and they're chanting Gauranga's name. But otherwise, then. So, where were we? Someone put it, so push back. You lose the screen. Liberation of taste?
Liberation of taste.
Okay. So then the devotees then are there because they have the taste of serving Krishna in a particular way. They automatically do those things. And the main devotees then show them. This is what's similar. They show how to serve. Radharani trains the other gopis in how to serve Krishna. Mother Jashoda trains the other gopis how to serve Krishna. The leading cowherd boyfriends, they train. Right? The servants, they're training. It's mentioned that Madhavendra Puri, he's the original Kalpa Riksha. Right? He's the one that Radha Govinda is sitting under. So he trains all the other Kalpa Rikshas how to behave as Kalpa Rikshas. Because otherwise they wouldn't necessarily know. So, but there it's based on the rasa, that interaction, that rasa, that taste. Does that make sense? So that's what's similar. But at the same time is following it, the form of it, and following it because it's the rule, that's what's given up. So it says the rules are given up means that following them because it's the rule. There they follow it because that's rasa. Right? But because we don't taste rasa, therefore it becomes a rule. You know, it's just like this. Okay, then, you know, okay. So then, okay, what are you supposed to do? Okay, you win the beauty pageant, right? So then, okay, so then they can do all kinds of things. You know, they can take their hands and go, like this, or they can, you know, do it another way, like this, or, you know, different ways you could do, like this. So they'll sit in front of the mirror and, you know, choose which one they want to use. But if the when the moment comes, it's just going to happen naturally. You know what I'm saying? When the emotion is there, the rasa is there, the external automatically happens. But if you don't know, then you have to show them. Does that make sense? So dropping it because it's the rule, oh, now I'm supposed to go, ahaha, and then shake my hands. Okay, that's dropped. But because of the mood, it happens automatically. So that's the difference. But that's picked up what you do from the other residents of Vrindavan. So therefore that's following the footsteps. So even our following the rules and regulations has to be according to following the footsteps. Because we imitate, right? Prabhupada mentions, okay, the Goswamis are, you know, sitting there in Vrindavan and they wear a little white piece of cloth and, you know, like this and that. So then there's people who copy that dress. And then they consider, now I am a Goswami. So that's imitating. So they're saying, okay, this is the rule. You go to the, probably some of the most rigidly attached to rules and regulations will be the Babaji's in, you know, in Vrindavan and in Navadvipa. Means you have to wear a certain kind of cloth. It has to be a certain length. It has to be a certain color. You know, it's you're worn in certain ways. When you eat in a certain way. You sit in a particular order. You have to say a certain amount of jais on everything that's in Vrindavan or Navadvipa. You know, so many rules are there. I mean, they're as strict as the smartest. But they feel that they're spontaneous and just rasa. Because they don't know. They don't know it's rasa, so therefore they mistake these rules for rasa, but others following rules that are different than them, then they'll say, oh, they're Vaidis, and we're Raghavadis. So that's the thing, is that it's when one opens one's mouth, that's when you tell what's going on inside. So they look good until they open their mouth, and then you can see, oh, here's a Vaidhi sadhaka, dressed up as a Babaji. Like that. and Vaidhi Sadhaka at best. It means it's their own Vaidhi. You know, where does it say that you're supposed to wear, you know, cloth like this? You know, where does it say you're supposed to wear marking cloth? Right? Like that. You pick up what's on the road. You know, Gaurakishore Das Babaji Maharaj says, what's the problem? What's the need for economic development? You need cloth. You just go down to the burning ghat, and after they burn the dead bodies, then there's so many cloths there. Right? Everyone comes and takes their bath, then you're fully in the clothes, then they drop those clothes there, and then they put on fresh clothes, and then they leave. You know, so there's so many. They cover the body in a cloth, and then they take that off, and then they do the ritual. So much cloth is there. What do you need? You know. So whatever it is, it may be a fine Shantipuri dhoti, but you know that's what you're wearing. You know. So it doesn't matter. But they know you have to wear marking cloth. You wore something else other than marking cloth, you wouldn't be a bona fide Babaji. You know. So. This is the thing, is that one is that there's a whole system that just becomes dropped, but it's actually the attitude is dropped. But the principle of following in the footsteps, that remains. That's what's common. That's the direct reflection. In the reflection, you can take it as it is. It just becomes reversed. There, we have the mood, so then we follow the direction. Here, we don't have the mood, we follow the direction, then we get the mood. So that's the reflection. But the principle is the same. Right? So even in following the rules and regulations, it still has the same principles. But you get this. Does this make sense? In other words, you're getting something where what you do here is the same as you do there. At the same time, there's in that process, there's something that's dropped. Does that make sense? That's why our line is very difficult to understand. Because of this. Other lines, it's no. They're going to be doing their varnashram duties with their family, and when they get to Vaikuntha, they're going to be doing the same thing. Like that. You know, you have husband and wife, and they're in Vaikuntha, and they serve the Lord, and the duties that men do is what the men are doing, the duties that women do are what they're doing in Vaikuntha. Everything's the same. As they're in the spiritual body, here and here you're not. But in Vrindavan, everything may change completely because it's simply based on that element of spontaneous rasa. So it has a slightly different form. But at the same time, the principles of it are the same principles that run Vaikuntha, are the same principles that run the material world in its pious form. It's the same principles that run the material world in its impious form. So if you understand the principles, you don't see any difference moving from one to the other. Therefore, Bhishmadev can move from talking Varanashram into simply about the taste of just the Lord and His beauty and the rasa of interaction with His devotees. Right? Just within a moment. He's just talking that, gives a conclusion, then he just absorbs himself in the Lord, and now he's just offering these prayers. So, because he sees the principle. A consistent principle. So for him to change from one to the other is no problem. Like that. So if the principle is gained, that's called sara grahi. Sara means essence. Grahi means one who grasps. So the sara grahi devotee grasps the essence. From that essence, that's always consistent. Details change. But this, the essence is always there. Doesn't matter what the rasa is, it functions the same. The principles that shantaras work on are the same as what conjugal ras work on. Just the details will be different. It'll be more intense, more full. The same principles. Like that. So everything works the same. Doesn't matter what you're dealing with, it's always the same. So if that's understood, then it's seamless. Moving from one to the other. If it's not, then you run into problems. Because something has to be given up, something has to be gained. You know, so then that's a problem. So one has to try to, appreciate that there's so many subtleties of the Krishna consciousness movement, and they're all important. They all have their place. You overemphasize one, then naturally there'll be a problem, right? If you overemphasize sweets, then that will create a problem. Or you overemphasize chili, or you overemphasize sour or bitter, or like this. There's a balance, a natural balance that maintains health. And depending upon where you are in the meal, then something will be, you know, manifest. Right? If you've eaten the meal, then at the end of the meal you're just eating sweets, no one will say that's wrong. But if all you do is only eat sweets, then someone might say there's something wrong. So in the devotional process, then it's there. Right? If one appreciates the how do you say? The form of it, then for those who actually, even in Shukta, there's a sweetness. For those who like Shukta, they like it because there's a certain sweetness there. They can taste the sweetness in the bitter. Otherwise, most people just get the bitter up. It's not nice. But those who know it, then they taste it, and it's sweet. Everything's sweet. Like that. Does that make some sense? Is that okay?
Could you please explain the difference between perfection or bhakti attained by Vaidhi Sadhana and perfection attained by
What's the difference between perfection attained by those in Vaidhi Sadhana and those on Raghunuga Sadhana? Here it's important to understand terminology. Perfection means liberation. You understand? Because prema is beyond perfection. Right? Perfection is something you obtain. Prema is a state of existence. Right? Because so perfection is in comparison to, right? To be perfect means there has to be something that's not perfect. But what I'm saying is bhava and prema are beyond perfection. Perfection means liberation. So for us, that's Brahma-bhuta, as Vaishnavas. As the non-devotees, then it's called moksha, liberation. For the devotees, it's called Brahma-bhuta, the platform. So it's beyond perfection. So, in either one, by Vaidhi or by Raghunuga, you can get to the platform of Brahma-bhuta. Both will get you there. But after Brahma-bhuta, if one is interested in spontaneous devotional service, then Vaidhi Sadhana is left, because once you're liberated, you don't need the rules to make things work for you. You already have the bud of, prema has begun. And so you have the association of the eternal associates, then it works. But until you're liberated, then the rules can't be given up. Because Raghunuga Sadhana means you follow the rules and regulations because you like to. Vaidhi Sadhana means you follow the rules and regulations because you're supposed to. That's the only difference. Externally, you will not see the difference. If you see the difference, there's something wrong. You know what I'm saying? The point is if you're taking, we also follow Vaidhi Sadhana. Means sadhana bhakti means practice. It's a sadhana. It's not perfection. That's the first thing. So when some talk about Raghunuga bhakti, the point is we're on the platform of Raghunuga Sadhana. So it's sadhana. It's a practice. That means it's not us yet. We're trying to make it us. We're aspiring. In other words, we're aspiring for Raghunuga. The real Raghunuga begins after liberation. When you come to the Brahma-Buddha platform, then you have the spiritual, facilities to deal with it. You have a spiritual form. You're in the spiritual world. You're doing the spiritual things. You're in spiritual association of the eternal associates. Then you follow in their footsteps. They have Rag. We follow it, Raghunuga. Right? That's the meaning of Raghunuga. We follow in the footsteps of those who have Rag. So that can be done from any platform, even from the platform of Vaidhi. So our Vaidhi is not cut and dry. This is the problem, is we have this computer mentality, little boxes with little arrows and like that. So here is Vaidhi, here is Rag. But they're overlapped. a rasik doesn't see the difference except in flavor. There is no difference. Those who make it a difference, those are vaidisadakas. Because they're making, no, you have to read this rasik literature. You have to hear from this pure devotee. You have to. Have to means vaidhi. That's the definition of Vishnu. As soon as they say you must, that's vaidhi. So you can just tell them, hey, Mr. Raghunuthi, get out of my face. Let's get real. You're more of a vaidhi sadhaka than we are. We in ISKCON, we don't know what the rules are, so we don't follow them. You know the rules. You're following them. So get out of our face. You're the vaidhi sadhaka, not us. You know, you have to read those books. You have to hear from this person. It's all vaidhi. All vaidhi. We also hear Krishna's pastimes. So, what makes them Raghunuga and us vaidhi? We like to hear Krishna's pastimes. We like the kirtan. So what's the name? We love prasad. Come on. We're great Raghunuga bhaktis. You know, spontaneously attracted to, you know, the prasad. You know? So this is the point, is that it is the mood. If we're going to talk mood, then we talk mood. It's not the form of it. The form of it's already established by the acharyas. And that nectar devotion gives the form of it. You follow that, you're on the path. You don't follow that, you're not on the path. Just because you feel like it doesn't make it sadhana bhakti. So the difference between raganuga and vaidhi is simply that. One, you do it because you have a taste. You go to Mangalarti because you like going to Mangalarti. You like being there and the kirtan, seeing the deities. You like it. That's why you're going to Mangalarti. Vaidhi is, I'm going there because I'm supposed to. It's a Brahma Muhurta. It's the best time of the day. That's the best thing for spiritual life. We make advancement just by being in front of the deities. So much, millions of lifetimes of sin is going. We clap our hands. Even more goes. We dance in ecstasy. More than that goes. But it'll look exactly the same. If you look from the outside, you won't tell the difference. In fact, if you really want to know, the one who's following it better and is normal, relaxed, you know, he's not uptight, that's probably a sadhaka, a raganuga bhakta. The one who's following it strictly and is uptight, they're definitely a vaidhi bhakta. Because their senses, everything, they're not getting taste from it. It's only intellectual. But the person who's following it and getting taste, that's spontaneous. So they're natural, they're relaxed, they're normal. You know, like that. You know, it's just like one devotee was saying once, who, you know, was with Prabhupada and trained by Prabhupada. He said Prabhupada was the most normal person that they've ever met. Everybody else is crazy. Prabhupada's normal. Right? So that's the thing. He's normal. So as you advance in devotional service, you become more and more normal. So this is the thing. It's not I do this and it's raganuga, I do that. It doesn't matter. Like that. Whatever is absorbed here, this is spontaneous. He's attractive. But he likes to express that through rules and regulations. Therefore, he maintains the sadhana, the vaidhi platform. But it's not sadhana. Right? This is vaidhi bhakti. Right? Not vaidhi sadhana bhakti. It's different. Right? He likes to express it through the rules. It's a medium he likes. Well, Vrindavan, they express it, the rule is followed, but because they establish the rule. What the Brajvasis do, that's the rule. But they're not doing it because it is the rule. They're doing it because that's the natural flow of affection. Then their natural flow is taken and put into something else, right? You understand? Like somebody does something expert. Someone comes to this festival, someone comes, leads a great kirtan, everyone's in ecstasy. Then after that, everyone will copy whatever that person did in that kirtan. So for the person who led the kirtan, it was just he wanted to sing this way, or wanted to sing that way, or change the tune, or jump up and down, or play the kartals this way. It was just what was naturally flowing. But for everyone else, oh, if I play the kartals this way, then everyone will get fired up, or I change the tune like this, everyone will get fired up. And then people don't get fired up, and then they'll say, hey, what's wrong with everyone? They're all in my end. No, it's just like, okay, you follow the rules nicely, but it's dead. You know, it's not happening. And so therefore, you know, no taste. So so it's a subtle thing to see what switches and what's the same. Maybe that's what we want to mean, is that that's the point, is that you're dealing with something that's going to go as it is here is how it is there, the principle. But the form of it then reverses. So that point where it reverses, that's the point of the bewilderment. Because simultaneously something is the same at the same time, it's just switching, it's reversing. Like, you don't have to follow the rules. So that's from our viewpoint, you don't follow our rules, but they're following the flow of rasa. If they don't follow that, it's called rasa bhas. But it's not a rule, it's just the natural manifestation of that symptom. Somebody's very happy, like Rupa Goswami gives, I think it's 6 loved forms of happiness, right? First is just a little bit of a smile. The next is the teeth show a little bit. Next on that, the teeth show more. Next after that, then there's kind of laughing. Then it gets to the point where they're jumping up and down and clapping and like that. So he shows these different levels. But that comes naturally when that kind of happiness is attained. So therefore, it's the science of rasa. But now you can take that and put it into rules if you want. Right? If you need. So within Varnashram, they put it into rules. Like that. Pancharatra, they partially put it into rules. Right. Does that make sense? So they'll say, okay, in this situation, you should smile. Varnashram will say that. Then it'll work for you. Because someone who had that mood would smile. You don't know that, you just smile. Then it'll happen. Then the other person will respond to that. Then you'll get the taste, it'll start. In other words, you have to kick-start it. In the spiritual world, the rasa is happening, the externals manifest. In the material world, they have the externals, but it's dead, and you have to do something to kickstart the rasa. Does that make sense? So therefore, that's why one must be forgiving or tolerant or merciful or all these different things. You have to have these qualities, otherwise you're not going to taste rasa. Issues, yes, but rasa, no. Because issues technically aren't rasa. That's why they're so boring. People who are into issues become with time more and more strange. They become more and more difficult as persons to interact with because they're not tasting rasa. Senses are rasa. Religion is rasa. Issues are in between. It's got a little bit of both, but it doesn't really get you either. That's why people, they're free. And it's the same, the impersonalists on the other side. All it is emotional impersonalists. Though the fun thing is that Platon is always presented as the most personal, like that. But that's just a show. They're just impersonalists. The other side is in between prescribed duties and transcendental rasa. That's the platform of liberation. That's moksha. Right. So the platform of artha and the platform of moksha, neither of these are actually taste. They're in between, they have a little bit of either on the other side. But they're not, so therefore you can't stay there. Right? Dharma, Kama, and Bhakti. These are the platforms of rasa. The Bhakti is real rasa, and Dharma and Kama are temporary. So you can't stay, and you always have to change. Right? Means sense gratification, you have to change it constantly in this lifetime. And Dharma, it has its natural flow in this lifetime, you change it for next lifetime. You know, so one is a lifetime taste, another time is a little shorter. Like that. Yes.
In the beginning, the taste from the form of sadhana, and you should go deeper. What does that actually mean? Because the rasa is the spiritual rasa. What we want, the real thing, you have to. You know, actually, we can do that either. When it comes, when it comes.
Yeah.
So,
how to gain? Oh, how to gain the? What does it mean by going deeper? What does it mean by going deeper into devotional life when tasting a devotional life or the rasa is not dependent upon externals? Because factually, there's nothing you can do to gain bhakti. Bhakti is born from bhakti. That's the problem. You know, so it has to be given. So main thing is to be open to it. This is why I was making this point, is that you bring up rasa in a general assembly of devotees, you'll immediately walls go up. And if you bring up varnashram, immediately walls go up. That means they're closed to the topic. So therefore, how will bhakti manifest? You know, whatever they're open to, it will manifest from there. But as we see here, Bhishma Dev, and this is on the level of Vaikuntha, he's able to taste both of these. Let alone Vrindavan. You know? I mean, Maru Mangal is a Brahmin. And he acts as one. And the rasa is based on that. You know, Nanda Maharaj, Krishna, and the other, they're Vaishyas. And they act according to that. In Mathura, they're the kings. They have their servants, their shudras. They all act according to it. And that's where the rasa comes. Maru Mangal tells Krishna, hey, you give me some ladus, then I'll make some arrangement for you to meet Srimati Radharani. Right? Because as a Brahmin, he can enter into any sphere. Right? Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, they can't go anywhere. Where they're supposed to be, they can go. But a Brahmin can walk in anywhere. A Brahmin can walk into the house. You know, there's no closed door. So he can walk in and say something. Others can't. The cowherd boys couldn't do it. So, using the brahminical occupational duties, he's using that to please Krishna. But he just wants to please Krishna. And in his rasa, you know, his friendship, then what's available for him, you know, what gives him the taste is doing it through brahminical duties. Yeah, yeah. No, but what I'm just saying is just on rasa. In other words, devotion is coming from devotion. So unless one is open to that, devotional happiness is there, devotional pleasure is there in the devotional process, and that comes by trying to please Krishna, then when it does come, one won't like it. You know? It means the mediums through which the taste and devotional service can come, one has to be open to them. Then, it's not the activity that's done, it's that you're doing it to please Krishna. If we're doing it because it's a rule, that's why it's less efficient. Because the rule itself is not going to get you bhakti. But that you're doing it because Krishna has established it that way, and you want to please Krishna by following his rules, that is a symptom of bhakti. So it's because of that that one advances. But now if you take it, I want to do this because I want to please Krishna, then it's quicker. Because then more directly you're dealing with bhakti. That I want to please Krishna through this service. So it's more direct. If it's just, I'm doing this service because I'm supposed to, but, you know, God's the one who said I'm supposed to, therefore it's there, but it's more indirect. When I want to do it to please Krishna, that's more direct. When I want to please Krishna and the facility I have available is these rules and regulations, that's even more direct. And then when it comes to bhava, then one's dealing with the spiritual form. Then it becomes even more direct. And then when it's prema, then that's the goal. So that's the point, is it's the attitude. It's the attitude. You know, it's the mood. So that's what makes the difference. Like the mood between Vaidhi and Raganuga, the difference between Vaidhi and Raganuga is simply a mood. Or the difference between Vaikuntha and Vrindavan is a mood. Otherwise, they're doing the same things. So the residents of Vrindavan are also worshipping Krishna with the 16 idols. But just the manifestation of it's different because of the mood. Like that. Yeah, deeper means the attitude. Like that. It means we're more conscious of what's going on. We're more conscious of what is there. Like that. So. So, you know, we're conscious of more things. So that's what's special, is the residents of Vrindavan, their consciousness is, you know, very special, because it's the subtlest thing, you know, is able to, is, is able to be. Yeah.
Very fine,
yeah. So that's the thing, it's just very fine, but it's so, so special that Lord Chaitanya first gives it to the most gross. You know, that's his fun, right? You know, Jagai Madai get it first, right? You know, they're the first, like, you know, major people picked up by the Sankirtan movement. You know, later on you get the Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and Prakashananda Saraswati and people who are more refined. You know, but in the beginning, then Jagai Madai, they're first on the list. You know, so that's the that's the fun. Is that okay?
And sometimes it happens that rasas are, there are two different kind of rasas, and then sometimes it's not appreciated by either each different groups. Like one group doesn't like the cooking of the other person, and then opposite, you know, like one doesn't like Italian, doesn't like Bengali.
Doesn't like Bengali soup.
Whatever, and then, or either like music, or even in spiritual world, sometimes you see that, like, Yashoda want to protect Krishna, and go, the cowboys, they go and take him out and go to different dangerous places, and so how this should be dealt properly?
That's etiquette. That's the reason for Vaishnava etiquette. Because etiquette is actually the culture, because you have the philosophy, but the philosophy has to be applied. So when it's applied, that's etiquette, that's culture. So also, as many times the devotees are afraid of our culture, that means they're afraid of actually applying the philosophy. Devotees won't mind basic philosophy, you know, but when it comes to culture, then it's too freaky, because that means you have to apply it, and applying it, then you have to, there's austerity. One has to give up, one has to be trained, one has to, because the difficulty comes is, most places in the world, it's understood if I want something, I have to work for it. That's the general principle most everywhere in the world, except for one country. This country, you have what's called the maverick. The maverick simply means, because he has the spontaneous, mundane desire to do it, he turns from the 90-pound weakling, you know, into Rambo, because of the feeling, the mood. That's the way it is. You always see in American themes, no one is ever trained in anything. They just do it. Like that. So it's like, therefore you have the culture there in the spiritual world, it's that. And then, you know, whatever's the highest there becomes the lowest here. But unfortunately, because it's reversed, you think you're on the top of the pile. So therefore this country feels that they are the leading, you know, cultural, you know, how you say, acme of, maybe it should be acne, but whatever, you know, of culture. So this is a problem. So devotees don't want to take the effort that it takes to learn something, to do something, to put in the time. Because what's the need? We're just trying to get this. And because of this, what we were saying before, being stuck on the issue platform, which is the platform of justice, economics, like that, then it's just what gets it done. Because the pragmatist means just what gets the result. And result must be economic, because without money, nothing happens, right? Money's the honey. So it means even for us, we need money, but that's not our goal. But you see the commonality there? There's a whole mentality that's there based on pranamoya. And that's what's becoming more and more prominent in the society. And as it becomes more and more prominent, you see that the preaching goes down, relationships go down. Everything in the name of going up, it's just becoming worse and worse and worse, because the platform of pranamoya doesn't establish relationships. It's upadharma, right? In Bhagavatam it starts out, upadharma is kicked out. You have to establish real dharma. What Bhishma is speaking, that's real dharma. Real dharma, Krishna will descend into. Krishna does not descend, the Akhokshija principle, does not descend into upadharma. He descends into dharma, And if Upadharma and sense gratification are connected to Dharma, then they will be connected. But Krishna will only descend as far down as Dharma. He won't descend lower than Varnashram. He won't descend into an ism. So if a devotee says, I'm doing this for Krishna, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know our philosophy. They have no idea of what's going on in Krishna consciousness. Like that. So this, it's a science. So it doesn't go by just what I feel. It works for born-again Krishnas. It works for the maverick in the book and in the movie, but it doesn't work in real life. The guys that run the American society work. They've gone to school. They've been trained. They're austere. Right? But to keep them on top, everybody else thinks has to think that, oh, I'll just do it. Right? That's all it is. Okay, I've decided I'm going to get into surfing. So all I have to do is get myself some fancy shorts, get myself some, you know, nice shades, get myself some, you know, number 30, you know, sun cream and some of that bright green stuff for my nose, get myself a fancy board, get myself a card with a rack on top to put it on, you know, get myself a few, you know, dice to hang, you know, from the rear view mirror, like that. And, you know, you really want to get into it, then you need a raccoon tail off the aerial. You know, all these different things, you know. Then, you know, then you do these things. Then, I'm the top surfer. You know, like that. But it doesn't work like that. This is an L.A. surfer. Not this type of surfer. Come on. Goes on your 57 ship. So, is that making sense? It's like, it won't descend down into that. So this is the difficulty, is this platform of pranamoy, because it seems I'm doing it for someone else. I'm extending my sense gratification into someone else. Therefore, it seems noble. It seems religious. It even seems spiritual. For non-Vedic religions, it's called spiritual. Because they never actually get to the platform of religion. So it's a religious experience, right? Even a subtle sensual experience is considered religion. That means spiritual. I go into the forest and it's quiet, you know, no cars. It's a spiritual experience. But that was just a subtle sensual experience. But I did it for others. I work for the blue whales, you know, it's like that. The kids in, you know, wherever, Somalia, like that. Then it's considered spiritual. So that's this. If you don't know the science, then devotees, especially from that kind of religious background, will easily make that mistake. Easily make that mistake. Because it's just based on the mood. You know what I'm saying? That's the whole point. Protestant religion is based on Bob. I have the mood, it's me and God and Jesus, that's it, I don't need anything else. All the culture is removed. No music, no architecture, no dress, no nothing. It's all removed. Right? That's the thing. You go to, you know, Catholic, so much is there. They get into every detail. The Protestant, they threw all that out because they said that's the form, we just want the mood. So then we have to be careful. That's conditioned nature. We don't bring that into devotional service. So because of the Protestant religion, therefore this economic development, this atheist economic development can come up. Otherwise it can't. You know, you don't see this previous to Protestant. It can't come up because it's everybody's mood. So how can I say my mood's better than your mood, or my mood's right, yours not? Right? But your Orthodox, your Catholicism, your Judaism, Buddhism, you know, Jainism, Confucian, they have some rules. So therefore, you have to follow this. But this is, so it restricts it. So that's why they're saying it's the Dark Ages, it's this, it's that. But in the rise of these others, then, oh, now everything takes off. Why? Because now everyone just does what they want. And what takes off? Economics. That's what takes off. And if you have economics, then the other things happen. Right? Michelangelo is only laying on his back doing Sistine Chapel because he's getting paid. Right? He's not doing it for free. You know what I'm saying? All these things are happening because people are being paid. Right? I think it was like Mozart wasn't being paid. That's when he died. You know? So that's, you know, it definitely is not advantageous for art to progress if there's no one being paid. That's why kama comes after artha. But that's based on dharma. So because it was dharma, they had artha, therefore they had kama. Make sense? So if we pick that middle platform, we can never be successful. Because it's fallacious that it's actually a social system. It's not. That's the problem. It's projected that it is. So because of that, then so many mistakes are made within the application of the philosophy. Because when you apply the culture, then the culture means it's set. You just follow it. But now it's whether you can follow it with feeling. Right? Like an orchestra performs a piece of classical music. It's not that, well, how they improvised or what they... No, it's how perfectly they did it with feeling. Then it's considered a good performance. You know, or a drama. It's done perfectly with proper feeling. It's a good performance. It's not that, oh, he made up his own lines. You know? It's not like that. You know, it's not sitting there going, ooh, out damn stain. You know, he's not doing that. It's like he's saying the right words and the right attitude. Then people are impressed. So that's the principle, is that you simply need a form. So it's either we follow a traditional form or we make one up. Now some will say, the uninformed will say, we can't use the traditional form. But that's the statement of the uneducated. Prabhupada used it to advantage. He got thousands of people in the door, opened hundreds of temples, made tons of money using tradition. It worked. And the more we go away from tradition, we see the less it works. So that's the point. Because tradition is the central feature of human society. Human means one who follows Varnashram. He is human. He doesn't, he's not. That's the bottom line. Because in Varnashram, you have to inquire, who are you? Because you can't fit into Varnashram unless you know who you are. Right? So just to be in it, you have to inquire. So it's automatic that following it means it forces you to ask. So it forces you to be human. And because it's constantly changing, there's constant rites of passage and development, so constantly you have to review yourself and your development. Right? So now, knowing that, then how you relate to someone else. Unless you know who you are, you won't know how to relate with someone else. That's why all these isms don't work. They don't know who they are. Therefore, they don't know who the other person is. Therefore, there's no relationship. They only talk that there's one, but it's only talk. You have a meeting and everyone talks about how nice it'll be, but when they leave that meeting, nothing happens. Nothing goes on. It just doesn't happen. Where does it happen? Name me one committee that's met and afterwards something's changed on the cultural platform. Name me one. I can't think of it. I haven't been to every meeting there is. I've been to a lot of them. I know a lot of friends who go to these meetings. You know? I haven't heard of one. So that's the point, is that it's talk. It sounds good. Oh, it'll be very nice. But that's not how it works. It's not how people apply it in their life. Therefore, there's no change. So until the individual changes, you can't change the society. The idea is, I'll change the society, then I'll change. But that's false ego. I'll only change if everybody else changes. I'm not about to be an idiot. Now, why I should be forgiving, they're not. So therefore, I'm not going to forgive. No, you started. You know, you have to start somewhere. So the person who starts, that's the leader. Right? So then it works. So these are given. And it works. Yudhishthira is the leader because he forgives. Bhima is not the leader. He is a leader, but he's not the leader. Because he forgives on everything except justice. But Yudhishthira is the leader because he even forgives on the platform of justice. Even though it's judicially wrong, he still forgives. Therefore, he's the emperor. And Bhima is a Kshatriya. Because he'll forgive everywhere but on justice. That's a Kshatriya's weakness. They can't forgive on justice. The passion is too strong. It has to be right. So it's natural. But as a devotee, we see as Yudhishthira, then it can be done. Right? Vaishya can't forgive on the platform of morality. Because if morality is dropped, then economics is dropped. You steal my stuff, you know, I can't make money. You don't respect my wall, you don't respect my... Then it's all gone. So for them, then that's the thing. Mm-hmm. And for a shooter of pain, can't figure out pain. Right? So anything anybody does that might make them more famous than themselves, immediately jealousy, envy, this and that. So these you see, and I mean, I'm looking around, and any issue I hear is all based on these three. You know, it's wrong according to the book because it's justice, or it's wrong because it's morality, and therefore we have to be moral and all that. But it's economics, or it's you know, this one, who do they think they are? This one, that one. So think about it. These are where the problems lie. It's the science. The Krishna conscious science is dynamic. It does work. Therefore, we can strongly and boldly say someone who says it doesn't work now is uninformed, uneducated, untrained. It doesn't matter who they are or who they think they are. They're uneducated and untrained. Because the system is made by God, it always works. So it works today. It'll work tomorrow. Manu's definition of modern, he gives one, is that which is not Vedic. It's a simple definition. What's not Vedic, that's modern. Because modern means what's happening today. Because if it's Vedic, it's eternal. And anything that's not Vedic is temporary. So therefore, one who's modern sees today, what's happening today. What's happening tomorrow, they're not necessarily so worried. What happened yesterday, that's out of it. That's finished. So that's the simple definition of modern. So the universe still functions on the universal principles. So it still works. You can't name one of the material 24 material elements that don't work as if it did when it was created. You can't name one species of life, you know, that doesn't function the way God created it. Right? Manu makes that very clear. As God created it, that's the way it works. And God, the far out thing, God creates it according to the way the Shastra says. Because He wrote the Shastra. So what's in the Shastra and how He made it are the same. And how Manu spoke it is the same. Therefore, there's a consistency between what the scriptures say, means what the Veda says, is the Shruti, what the Smriti says, what Manu says, and what is observable. In the material energy. So you can't beat that. And it says anyone who doubts that or rejects that, that person should be dealt with as if they're an outcast. You don't marry into the family, you don't deal with them intimately, you have nothing to do with them. Because they're an atheist. Manu doesn't mind. He just says they're an atheist. They don't accept the Vedic version, they're an atheist. Like that. It's very simple. That's the thing. They're saying so complex. It is so complex. Because that's the technical, metaphysical aspects of it. But its principle is so simple. It's very, very simple. Right? But that's where it gets scary. it's so simple, it's so blunt that that is like, hey, I don't believe in it. That means I'm an atheist. So that's the principle. One is saying the application has to be applied for the time, place, and circumstance. That also Mana says. If you don't apply it according to time, place, and circumstance, it means you didn't understand it either. If you stick to the rule and don't understand how to apply it, it means you've made a mistake also. So we have to understand that these great personalities like Bhishma Dev, Manu, all these others, they know what they're talking about. They're all Mahajans. So as they say it is how it works. These Bhishma's teachings worked then, 5,000 years ago, they're working today. And he's quoting from history, right? He mentioned that he gave examples from history and everything like that. You understand? Oh yeah. Then he described the occupational duties of different orders and statuses of life, citing instances from history where he was himself well acquainted with the truth. So this history means it can go back to the beginning of creation. So we're talking 5,000 years ago. So basically that's the second, we're in the 51st year of Lord Brahma. So that means we've just crossed, what is it? Half, I mean it's 155 trillion years we've just crossed. And we're in the seventh manu. So that means seven manus. The day of Brahma. So it means 1,000 Mahayugas. Then times 360, which is a year, times 50. Right? So out of I think it's 500,000 manus, you know, or it means Kali Yugas, that'll be there. But actually a manu is for 72. We've already gone through like 250,000. Right? So, you know, it's been a while. So history means you could be anywhere between today and then. And even sometimes, because they're seers of the truth, they can talk about the future. They can talk about what will happen. Yeah, so then, there's no doubting. That was the point that Prabhupada made with that boy and the moon thing. You know, is Prabhupada said he could doubt me. Okay, I'm an individual. He may doubt me. But how could he doubt the scripture? Prabhupada was like, how can you doubt the scripture? The scripture is given by God. How can you doubt it? So that's the point. The scripture says it. It must be true. Now we have to see how to apply it. That's the thing. Then there may be so much discussion and trying to find the right thing. But it has to be taken as a basis. This is where it starts. Otherwise, if you don't start there, where do you start? Otherwise, then, yes, back to the Mormons, back to the Amish, back to the, what do you call it, Aurobindowallas and Pondicherry, you know, or whatever it is, you know, the Hottentots and Cape Town, or, you know, whatever, you know, whatever it is that we, you know, find that they have a great social culture. So I was telling you, I think yesterday, the day before yesterday, about one tribe, and there's this interaction between this tribe and a species of bird. And when the bird likes to eat the bees' larva and honey, but it can't get at the bees' larva and honey because of the bees. And the man likes them also, but the man can get at them. So there's this one tribe, is when they want to go out and find a beehive, then the man will sing a particular song. They've always sung it. You know, it's just somehow another generation, they sing it. And when they sing it, those birds will come and start circling around. And then wherever the honey place is, you know, where there's a bees thing, because they know where they are, because they want them, but they can't get out, then they'll start diving in the place, like that. And then the person will come there and then take out, you know, chase away the bees and get the honey and that. Then, why will the bird do that? Because then the hunter is supposed to then put some of that on the side for the bird. And if he puts a proper amount that the bird feels that, you know, it's proper, you know, it's a good business deal, then the bird will keep showing him where the nests, the bees hives are. If not, then he'll dive where there's a lion or a tiger or something very dangerous. Right? And then the guy will go over there and get caught and killed by the tiger. Like that. So then, you know, something to gain there, you know. We can discuss that, you know. How is it? Maybe we're singing the wrong song. Maybe the tune's not right, you know. So, like that, is that we accept the scriptures, and of the scriptures, the Bhagavatam, then we'll always be right. Because it says he's well acquainted with the truth. Truth is what's always right. Facts may or may not be always right, but truth is always right. So that's, there's a difference there. For those on the Pranamoy platform, truth means facts. And even facts are perceived facts. They don't even have to be actual facts. Just people perceive it that way. For them, perception is everything. So that means perception is the senses. So technically, even though they're, we can see, therefore that's why the Pranamoy is connected with Anamoy platform. Because perception of the senses is the lowest platform of existence. So the scientists and they're all, because they're working on their senses, that's their perception, therefore they're on the lowest level. Scientists are considered Anamoya as a religion. Right? So if we extend it up to Pranamoya, we accept life and all that, but it's still founded on perception. So that's why it can never be right. Does this make any sense? So it's a faulty platform, and devotees confidently stand on it, but devotionally, they're going to lose. Because the senses are sense gratifications on the Anamoy platform. Anamoy means the senses. So you have the working senses and the knowledge acquiring senses. You know, so then whichever of those that you use to gain your facts and figures as your starting point, then that's anamoy. So that's perception, that's pratyaksha. Anuman means what you perceive from it. So that's based on the senses, but the problem is it's still faulty because it may be right, may even not be right. You know, it's just like you hear a rumor. The rumor may be absolutely false, but the pat saying that the leaders always will say is, well, where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, very nice. Then define the fire. What is this fire? It must be something wrong, but what is wrong? Define it. They can't, because it's just sentiment. It's just a move. It's just an easy way out of management. You just nail something, move on. It's called, how do you call it? What's that kind of management called? You just deal with the problems. Crisis management. It's not management. Non-managers do crisis management. Managers plan ahead. Crisis has come, because it's the material world. Crisis management means they're not a manager. So it's a very easy way. You just, and then move on, you know. Caulking's going until somebody says, hey, put it into a committee or do this or that, and then bang, okay, finished, okay, that problem's gone. But we're not dealing with the real problem. We're not establishing the philosophy and culture. We're not establishing the practice. Because it's based on the senses. So pratyaksha is faulty. But shabda, when shabda becomes applied, where you, according to time, place, and circumstance, can see it on the ground as viewed, as pratyaksha, you can see it with your senses. That's what you want. When shabda is observable, then you've got the right combination. But to start from the other end, that's for the atheists. That's for the speculators. That's for the impersonalists. They start with pratyaksha. Then on that, they develop their anuman. You know, they develop their perception. So therefore, when you hear these things like that, well, perception is important. Perception is everything. It's an atheistic platform. It's not a devotional platform. You know, because Prabhupada said, good or bad doesn't matter. We're in the newspaper. It's a bad article, but people know we're there. And if people are intelligent, it means the intelligent person who are looking to make devotees. then they're going to make their own decision. Because they know newspapers, this, that, they're, you know, tainted. What's that called? The journalism? It's always got a bias to it.
Sensationalism.
What is the name? Colored?
Yellow.
Yellow, okay. Yellow journalism. They know it's like that. And people with brains know it. But at the same time, it may be a doubt, but they'll look out for it. But then if they see the devotees are nice, this, that, and they get the, well, who are these guys? Right? I mentioned it before. The most books on Islam were sold in the few weeks after 9/11. People wanted to know, who are these people? And it's not that they're thinking, oh wow, hey, great guys, you know, I always thought it was an eyesore, you know, it took up so much space in the skyline, you know, I'm really glad they knocked it down, you know, it's like, you know. It was that they were thinking, these guys are bad, but they want to know, who are they? So in the paper, who are these Hare Krishnas? Who are these guys with the bald heads? Where are they from? What's going on? What's the history? You know? So Prabhupada's point is it doesn't matter. Good or bad, we're known. But the modern only new good is good and bad is bad. That's not what Prabhupada said. So that's the thing. So then who's right? Our perception on the mundane world that's changing from moment to moment, or the reality of the scriptures that are fixed and always there? But one must also always remember that this is not a new thing. That's the problem, is devotees think that there's something new and unique. Oh yes, we're following the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, but we're modern, and so we're something new, we're something different. Like this has been going on for thousands of years, this illusion. It goes back to the time of the Greeks. You had the Sophists, and you had Socrates. Socrates said there's an absolute truth. We must learn that truth and judge, you know, our values in life and bring it in line with that absolute truth. That will get us perfection. And the Sophists, they said, no, whatever the mass says is true, that's actual truth. So perceived truth is real truth. You know, we're God, we make it up. That's why we say it's atheistic. Because if we make it up, then wait, hey, God says He establishes religion. So if someone else establishes it, that means they think they're God. You know, they may say, no, it's not like that. No, it's reality is reality. So then, but unfortunately, the Sophists were all the judges and leaders and, you know, managers in the society. And so then Socrates lost, the Sophists won at the time. But still the argument's going on until today. So it's not a new thing. That's the thing. Devotees shouldn't, just like Prabhupada mentioned, devotees said, oh, I'm the most fallen, Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, you're not the most anything. So you should never feel that we're so special and we're so different and we don't fit in. We have to create a whole new culture and whole... That's illusion. That's false ego. That's atheistic. No. Human life has already been created. The 8,400,000 aspects of it have already been created by God. There's not something new to create. Like that. Even the mixes, you know, the Varna, Shankaras, all these, they've already been created by God. Right? You mix a Brahmin and a Shudra, you get a Nishada. It's already got a name. It's already got a name. Or you mix a, what's that? Shudra man, Brahmin woman, you get a Chambala. Come on, it's already there. You mix those two, you get an Antishti. My Antyaja. You know, even the Chandalas and Nishadas won't go near that. You know, even they're considered, the outcasts consider them outcasts. Right? And then if you make a Nishada and marry that, a Nishada girl and marry that to, no, excuse me, yeah, Nishada girl, no, Nishada boy married to a Shudra girl, so the Shudra girl is actually higher caste than the boy, so it's Patiloma. Then they get a Svapacha. The dog eater. Right? So they're all there. The science of it's already made, so it's not that there's something there. You just take those modes, move it this way and that way. You know, and then you get McDonald's, you get Nike shoes, you get, you know, Ray-Ban sunglasses. It just comes, you know. And then a few years and all evaporate, you know, like where are the Romans now? You know, we're just in Rome, except for a few ruins. Where are the Romans? You know, it's not there, the culture's gone. You go to China, still the same culture is being taught. You still find you know, Buddhists what do you call them? Confucius, Taoists. They used to have the same thing, do the same rituals they've done for thousands and thousands of years. It's still there. You go to Italy, where it is? You know, it's gone. So it's like that. Even according to some, real pizza comes from New York. Of course, this is a very delicate discussion. You could start many, many blood feuds over this one. Tomato sauce feuds, right, whatever.
The Brits not came from Wales.
Ah, came from Wales. And I've even heard one man from Tamil Nadu say it's actually a South Indian. It's a tomato utapam. Just they bake it instead of, you know, they didn't know how to pour it out and get it to smooth out, so they had to bake it. So. Yeah, why not? So this is perception. Came from Wales. Really, what's the preparation called in Wales?
Welsh.
Welsh.
Rabbit.
Rabbit.
It's
rabbit.
Rabbit.
Welsh.
Rabbit.
Rabbit.
It's
rabbit. Rabbit. Rabbit.
It's rare.
Oh.
Welsh
rabbit. Oh, okay. Okay. And then you just put a few tomatoes underneath, and yeah, okay. Hey. Huh? It's called a French toast. No,
the American French toast.
Oh, American French toast is something else. Mm. Oh, see? Okay. Yeah, there we have it. The Welsh were there. Yeah, because the Welsh are Celts. So they're original people. Well, the Romans came in afterwards. They're from the later wave. Yeah, yeah. It must have been when they went to establish what it, Londinium or whatever it is, that they picked it up from the Welsh that were there. Took it back and then slowly it developed. They couldn't get the bread right? They couldn't get it to rise fully, so then they ended up in more flat. Yeah, it's amazing history, isn't it?
They even made roads to get there.
Just that they had to get there and get the Welsh rarebits, right? You know, it's just that it was so famous that they had to, you know, and they had to get through the Gauls to get there, right?
When they got it, they left. They pushed all the Brits back right after the Welsh, and then they left.
And that was it, then they headed back. And I guess when they came back to the other countries, then they picked it up, because they were in France at the time, and I guess the others picked it up, and so then they thought, oh, it's the French, French toast. This is all the unwritten historical. Somebody could do a PhD on it. Why the Romans actually went to England. No, the hot springs are after you eat the other one, then you can relax, and then, you know, helps digestion. Yeah, because it's a cold climate, so digestion is difficult. So. Really? I've never done that. Is that why Hitler was also trying to get into London?
He had the remains of the bakery in London.
Oh, I see. That made the real Welsh rare. So you end up with all this kind of stuff. Yeah. So then we have to turn to the scriptures. What is the scriptures actually say? You have to do some research.
We're getting kicked out of it. Where is it?
Yeah, where is it? The worst thing I had, I went to one Ayurvedic doctor. They took the pulse, everything, said I have this disease. So I said, any diet? He said, yes. He says, you have to very strictly, no oil, no tomatoes, and no wheat. I think he even mentioned no cheese. He said, that's it. This is not good.
Worse than you thought.
Yeah, yeah. I want a second opinion. So that's good. That's fine. He said, what do you call it? You know, yeah, pratyaksha and anumana are good for a laugh, but when it comes to reality, it's got to be shunned. You know, but when shabda becomes manifest, like what Janani Vaskar was saying, then it's something solid. When you can actually perceive the shabda with senses, then it becomes reality. Anything else?
Just one question that came to my mind, because you're speaking, there is this essential platform and there is these issues. Is modern psychology just issues, or is that why there is so much guilt?
Is modern psychology issues, or it's it would tend to be, it would even tend to be a little below, though it has some touch of it to raise it, because the problem is modern psychology is they don't really know the field. They observe the field. And then from that, they make their own conclusions based on their own issues. Because you can ask any modern psychologist to find exactly what is the mind. They can't do it. But the Vedas can. So they observe what are the effects of the mind. They can perceive that a mind is there. But they can't bring it any farther than that. Therefore, those in the hard sciences reject it. I was just reading the other day of one person, one of the leading physicists, and he said, I've been studying this question for 30 years, and I've come to the conclusion that there is no such thing as mind. Like that. You know? Huh? Yeah. Tell that to your wife then. Solve all the problems. You know, so that's the thing, they don't even know what the mind is. You know, so therefore then it gets, well, the girls always build, you know, things with big doors, and then the boys will build things that are very tall and thin. You know, I mean, they get into this kind of stuff. And, you know, it's like, nice, but, you know, why does it have to be interpreted in the way they interpret it? You know, a nice door means a facility, it means a beauty, it means, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, they'll always have to take everything back. It's got to be sensual. So their platform is sensual. Their observation is with the senses. And even though they're using their intelligence and other higher factors, their conclusions still bring it back to that platform. So, because it's basically more of a science, it would function even more down in the lower, with sciences than that. It's just a soft science instead of a hard science. Like that. So the real science is a hard science. Vedic psychology is a hard science. Because you know what the mind is, what the intelligence is, how they work, how the two interact with each other, how they interact with the senses. It's the full mechanics of it is described. And even what will happen in this situation, this will happen, that will happen. You know, and then you can go out and observe it. So it's a lot easier. Does that make sense? Like that. But doesn't mean you can't use it, because the modern psychology is good when someone's actually crazy, clinically crazy, to bring them to the neutral point. But that's where its use ends. Because the man who developed it only dealt with people who are clinically crazy. He never studied normal people, so therefore the science, that's where it ends. You know? But the unfortunate thing is he tries to project what's wrong with the crazies onto those who are normal. And like Prabhupada mentioned, I mean, some devotee was telling Prabhupada that according to, you know, this Freud, the Oedipus complex, then the son wants to have an intimate relationship with his mother. Prabhupada, there was a silence, and Prabhupada just said, maybe in your country, not mine. So that's the thing, is that there's a limit to it, because you're dealing with crazy people. There is a reflection. You have to be crazy to be in the material world. So there is an underlying principle. But the underlying principle is not necessarily how he's perceived it. Yes, everything's based on male and female, but they don't know what male and female is. Male and female is beyond the how do you say, the accessories, right? It's a mentality. And so that everything works on that. The whole, because Krishna's male and the expanding, you know, his energies is female. Therefore, everything will be based on that. Those two, it has to be. But that doesn't mean it's interpreted the way he does. That's the point, is it's a perception. So unless your perception is based on scripture, the perception has no meaning. That's the difference. Mental speculation, there's two aspects of it. One is you start from pratyaksha, then you speculate on it and try to get to shabda. That's what the impersonalists and the scientists and the academics, and they all do. The Vedic is, as you start from shabda, then you take and what you perceive, and then you try to figure it out, and that way then you speculate on it. But because it's based on the scriptures, then it's valuable. You know, you try to, how does this I'm not this body apply? And then you try this way, that way, so many things, until you start to nail it down and you start to see, oh, in this way. You know. Does that make some sense? So it has its limit. I've seen, if it's somebody who's crazy, I mean actually clinical, it can have some benefit. But that's it. But if you use it on people who are just disturbed, then its result is sense gratification. I can't say, because I haven't met many, but any reports that I've heard of devotees who tried to use modern psychology to help devotees, those devotees all bloop and go out and just get into sense gratification. Because they'll always have a pat answer. The reason you're having problems is because you restrict yourself. So if you just let go, you'll be fine. But if you want to fit into society, you have to restrict yourself. You can't walk down the wrong side of the, in the middle of the road. You can't drive on the wrong side of the street. You can't not pay your taxes. You can't not go to work. You can't. You have to restrict yourself. So the more you restrict yourself, the higher the quality of interaction. So therefore, even as a concept, it's completely bogus. But devotees who learn this, they parrot this. Because they themselves don't know what is mind and intelligence, so they don't know how to use their own. They become very expert in the field, but they may not apply their own. I've seen some devotees use it. They know how to use the metaphysics just to make people calm so you can discuss philosophy. But I only know one devotee who does that. But others, then they get into all kinds of things. But if you use it for helping crazy people, that is an occupation, it's fine. And if a devotee goes crazy, they can help. But to actually think it will solve the social problems of the society, you have to be crazy to think that. That's the thing. Because there's no material solution to spiritual problems. There's even no material solutions to material problems. There's only spiritual solutions to any problem. If it's not connected to spirit, it's dead. That means it can't act. Solution means alive. So alive means spiritual. So unless it's connected to the spirit, there is no solution. It's dead. And therefore you see devotees turn to all these things, they're dead. You know? And they move on. And then they move from one thing, you know, it was like, before it was, you know, what was it, the systems, and it turns into this, and it turns into that, and, you know, Cubby was popular for a while, and some still talk about him, others have moved on, now they're doing some other thing, and systems is old from the army, and like that, you know, it still wins wars, but, you know, somehow for devotees it's too old-fashioned, you know, all these things, it's just stupidity. Means we can use things in Krishna's service, but unless we see it in relationship to the Shabda, which means the scripture, it's stupidity. maybe very well thought out stupidity, very refined stupidity, but stupidity nonetheless. You know? And Prabhupada has no qualms in saying it right to their faces. So it's not us saying it, right? Who are we to say, right? We're as stupid as everybody else. But Prabhupada says it. Calls them fools and rascals. Nonsense. So it was fools, rascals, and nonsense in the 60s and 70s, and it's still fools, rascals, and nonsense in the 21st century. Like that. Still the same fools, rascals, and nonsense. You know? So as an occupation, it's fine. It works for the karmis. For the devotees, things don't work normally for the devotees. Only transcendence through Vedic really works. You know, it may work temporarily, but in the long term. Does that make some sense? Now, you'll excuse us if that's your occupation. Yeah, I ran into that problem once. Someone asked me, it's like, oh, what are you training the children in the Gurukul? And, you know, this. Are you training, you know, have you ever thought of training them, you know, in the field of law and as lawyers? It says, come on, modern lawyers, it says they're just intellectual prostitutes. They just sell their intelligence to win someone else's case who is a good chance they're, you know, lying. You know? And they're like, no, a lawyer really thinks that, you know, the person's right and things like that. And, like that, and it says, you know, sometimes you get a good lawyer, but most of them is just money. It says, you know I was going with the devotees working on an NM Day case for 10 years and sitting with the lawyers, and you know what goes on. You know, you go into the court and that's all. So, you know, it seems Perry Mason is just to give people faith that lawyers are okay. You know, so whatever it is, that it's like, hey, you know. And then later on, I found out from some devotee that the guy was a lawyer. After saying that, but, you know, he wasn't about to mention it. So. Like that. Not politically correct, no. You have something? Come on. No?
Meaning the new majority.
Yeah, above.